This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I am joined here with Joshua Zeidner and Charles Lincoln. We're going to be discussing the situation in South Africa. Great having you guys on the show.
Hey, good to talk here. It's been a very long time.
This has actually been getting in the news a lot lately, so I know the dissident right has been fascinated with South Africa for quite some time, and it's been an issue ignored by mainstream media. But now we have the president here, Trump. He tweeted, this was about a week ago, he said, "I have asked Secretary of State, Secretary Pompeo, to closely study the South Africa land and farm seizures and expropriations and the large-scale killing of farmers. South African government is now seizing land from white farmers." That was Trump's tweet, and this got massive coverage from the media. And then recently, what happened is actually the South African government withdrew their land confiscation bill due to Trump, because they genuinely feared that he would put some kind of economic pressure on. So, I mean, that's just really remarkable that you would have someone basically as powerful as a U.S. president openly addressing this.
I don't know. I mean, is it really that amazing? Because until 25 years ago, I mean, we actually, at least during the Reagan and the Bush 1 administrations, we were pretty friendly with South Africa. And up until like 1968, we were extremely pro-South African, and we valued their existence quite a bit as a stabilizing force in Africa. The transformation of all that is, I guess, something we should talk about. But as long as we got Joshua here, I just want to ask him to start off by talking. Before we got started, he told me that he has lived in Israel. Were you born in Israel?
No, I'm American. I have no Israeli citizenship, although I am eligible for Israeli citizenship. At least hypothetically. I've not actually gone through the process.
Well, you'd have to join the military, right?
No, I wouldn't have to join anything. It's mostly, it wouldn't come at any cost to me, aside from, you know, whatever costs are associated with getting up and moving there, which are quite significant.
Well, anyhow, no, what I really wanted to ask you was, do you think that the Israeli people and the South Africans are in similar positions with regard to their socio-cultural demographic environment in the regions that they exist in?
I think that the problems are certainly very similar in that, you know, you have one group which is what you would call Western. You know, they have a Western outlook. It's capitalistic. You know, they have access to military technologies, their first world, and their opposition is very much third world, I guess you would say. You know, the Arabs tend to be a lot more low tech, although that is changing somewhat. But generally, that's one of the features of the conflict. So I tend to think that South Africa has a similar problem. You know, it's very easy to characterize the whole, like, conflict as, you know, evil white man wants to attack the evil black man, but anyone who really looks at it and knows and is certainly responsible for an outcome of about it knows that's not really quite exactly what's going on there.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I do want to comment on something Charles brought up. So, with the whole situation with Ronald Reagan, that was primarily because of the Cold War. I mean, just look about John McCain. John McCain has been one of the worst senators as far as issues like his foreign policy and open borders go. Even John McCain at some point voted against sanctions on South Africa, and that was because John McCain was a major Cold Warrior. So what basically happened is the United States used South Africa as an ally in the Cold War, and South Africa was a nuclear power, so that was significant. But then once the Cold War ended, the U.S. threw South Africa under the bus. But with Israel, that actually is true. So Israel was one of South Africa's very last allies.
And
yeah, it's likely.
Is it fair to say that both Israel and South Africa are the last and most successful remnants of colonialism?
That is a very common theme in these discussions. You know, usually the opponents of Israel will say, oh, it's colonialism. You know, and obviously colonialism is bad. It's very easy to establish that colonialism is bad. Although certain, okay, so I'm aware of the arguments against that, okay? And we can discuss that.
Clarify it. I am sufficiently peculiar that to me colonialism is not necessarily an unmitigatedly bad thing. I didn't use it that way. I mean, I think that South Africa and Israel are in some ways almost as good arguments in favor of colonialism as, say, United States of America.
I'll tell you something interesting that's somewhat supportive of your perspectives is that, you know, one thing that Israel is doing is it brings capital and money into the region where it didn't really exist before. You know, one could argue that during the days of the Ottoman Empire, when it was going full steam, that really wasn't a problem. Although, really, the Ottoman Empire collapsed under its own weight. It wasn't really a victim of British colonialism. So, a lot of people say one advantage...
By the mid-19th century, they were calling the Ottoman Empire the sick man of Europe.
Right. It certainly, I think any historian would agree, any serious one, would agree that there were problems with it despite British influence, and I think the Brits sort of took advantage of that fact and just kind of went in there, they exploited it, and then eventually carved it up, and we have the Middle East that we have today. But, you know, going back to your, is colonialism good? I think to really understand it, you know, you need to stop using this term colonialism. It's kind of, it tends to suggest this idea of somebody coming there and taking things and enslaving everybody, and that certainly did happen. But that's not really all that happened. They also went in there and they built things, right? They developed the land and they built modern services, right? Like, so take a look at South Africa versus Botswana. I'm sure you've got loads of things to say about that, Charles.
What I really am thinking about is that as far as oppression goes, isn't it interesting that Israel's big problem is not how to keep its subservient Palestinians inside the country and working. Israel's big problem is how to keep the Palestinians out.
That's not altogether. I'm gonna disagree with that. That's not altogether true, because you go there and you live there and you see the Palestinians work the construction jobs. They often drive. They do these low-level sort of service sector work, which the Israelis, certainly the average Likudnik, is not really willing to admit that it's not just about a hostile group of people. It's about the tensions between the working class and the capital class, because they just don't want to give these people their full rights. You know, that would be an economic disaster for the upper class of Israel, and they certainly know that. It's a hidden feature to the conflict there.
This also ties in with South Africa, because one of the problems prior to the end of apartheid, there were these wealthy business interests that were dependent on the African labor. And,
no doubt.
And yeah, not just the South African blacks, but the large-scale importation of cheap labor from other parts of Africa. And, I mean, that led to a lot of the problems. If you just look at the history of South Africa, you had the indigenous people. I think they're called either the Bushmen or the Khoisan people. And they were there when the original Dutch colonists arrived in the 1600s. And then there were later waves of migration from other parts of Africa. And that happened under apartheid when there was great prosperity. But even today, South Africa has a huge problem with immigration from other parts of Africa. And there are these anti-immigration riots, but it's not so much white versus black. It's actually blacks in South Africa rioting against other Africans coming there because there's like a scarcity of resource. So that, I mean, that's actually been a huge issue, and that's, it's a global issue. It's an issue in Israel. It's an issue in Europe, America.
Right, and what is the easiest way to solve that problem is to instate a very rigid concept of citizenship that's not limited to either white or non-white. And those are the people that deserve the social benefits. You know, anyone else who wanders in isn't eligible for those things. As far as like Israel goes, I can't really say so much for South Africa. I'm not really an expert in the politics there, but that is the solution to solving the problems in Israel, is giving everyone a Bill of Rights like we have in America, which they do not have at this time.
Okay, I've got to ask you.
Yeah.
You said that the problem was an economic threat to the owners of capital in Israel, but
yeah,
I have heard the position taken, and I am somewhat sympathetic to it, certainly in South Africa I am, that to change the socioeconomic hierarchy in either Israel, in Israel, would lead to the kind of genocide that basically we're talking about, and that Trump was talking about in South Africa, and genocide.
So you're talking about basically giving a citizenship to the Arabs in the West Bank and Gaza. So basically, if you compare the demographic profiles of the two regions, within South Africa, the white population is something, it's less than 10%. I think it's 10%.
Yeah.
It might even be less than that, maybe 8 or 9%. And that puts whites in a very vulnerable position where basically democracy cannot exist, because when you have a large majority that's hostile towards you, right now in Israel, Israel, as far as Israeli citizens, there's a pretty strong Jewish majority. But what I heard, if you were hypothetically to grant the people in Gaza and the West Bank Israeli citizenship, there would be roughly like a 50-50 split demographically.
Well, but also you have growth patterns to consider.
Right? That's for sure.
Go ahead.
The birth rate is much higher among the Palestinians. Yeah. So, I mean, Israel would no longer be a Jewish state if you had one man, one vote.
Right. That's certainly a valid concern, but it gets interesting when you start to consider what do we mean by Jewish, right? I mean, the thing, it started off, you know, this kind of mentality, I think, had humble and somewhat honest beginnings. However, it evolved into something that is utterly absurd. I mean, these people like are reviving Bronze Age political ideas, literally. And, you know, it seemed to float in certain circles, you know, but it's really starting to bleed out of that, and it's becoming a very toxic kind of environment. You know, these hardcore Zionist settler people, they certainly do not agree with the American outlooks on how we view things, which is creating antagonisms between Israel and America that did not exist before. I mean, how many Americans are going to support the Holy Davidic Kingdom for affluent Ashkenazis? How many? Not very many.
Well, I mean, I think a surprising number actually do support it. You have the fundamentalist community, in particular, who endorse it. But I mean, I just want to change the dialogue a little bit here. Do the Zionist, the elite Zionist Ashkenazis you're talking about, do they have more or less right to their ideological dream of a new Israel than the Voortrekkers and the Boers have to their dream of a free white South Africa, South African Republic. I mean,
right. The magic word there is self-determination. Whenever you arrive at this, these, what you're talking about right here, you know, in the more professional debates, then this term will come up: self-determination. It's somewhat mysterious. No one really seems to quite know exactly what that means, and there's a lot of difference in opinion about what that means. But it seems to be some kind of idea that these people somehow have the right to enforce and to impose this concept of a kingdom, almost some sort of a feudal system. It's certainly not democracy, and you know, they have the right to impose that there. I mean, as far as I understand, there is no such legal granted, you know, there's no mandate that says that they should be able to do that, right?
There is in effect for Israel. There is not
the Bible. Okay. So do you believe in the biblical, that this is exactly what I refer to. I use the term, I say that's the biblical mandate. Do you believe in the biblical mandate?
It's not something I believe in. I'm approaching it more from the standpoint of social anthropology and political reality. And I'm saying I understood we were going to be talking about South Africa today, but since we have Israel, I mean, I'm aware that for a very long time, Israel and South Africa were basically best buddies, and there were Israeli. I think it was Robert who mentioned that South Africa has has nuclear power. It was Israeli nuclear scientists, by and large, Israeli and German, ironically enough, who came down and were helping develop South African nuclear power plants and industry and the electrical grid in South Africa generally. And because there was this tremendous political pressure in Western Europe and North America, especially starting in the early 80s against South Africa, Israel basically continued to be a conduit, even when Jewish people in the United States were pretty much lining up uniformly against South Africa. It was very bizarre. I was at Harvard in the 1980s when all this was going on, when they had these little camps on campus, shanty towns, and it was bizarre. The whole thing was very bizarre. You had basically Jewish people, Jewish students protesting white imperialism in the, you know, what arguably was the greatest, for a long time, the greatest symbol of American white imperialism around, namely Harvard University. It was very confusing, really.
Yeah, for sure. And Joshua, you were telling me that there's a strong presence of white South Africans within Israel. Have you talked to them about, like, what is their general position on the situation over there?
Sure. I was just about to kind of blurt that out. It felt like it was would fit into what Charles was just about to say. But you know, you go to Israel, and there's obviously a presence of South Africans there. For instance, biltong is an extremely popular food in Israel. I don't know if either of you guys have ever had biltong before.
No.
It's a kind of beef jerky, and you know, the food itself kind of tells a story too about how the society really works there. Biltong, in the early days of South Africa, the Dutch settlers, used to purchase preserved meat from the tribal Africans, and they would go out in the bush and they would sort of hunt down game, and then they would smoke it or dry it right out there in the field and then bring it in large quantities into the towns and sell it. It's very high quality meat. It's, you know, it's all free range, as they would call it today. So you go to Israel and you see how common these foods are. When I was there, as I mentioned in your last show that we did, I worked for two separate employers when I was in Israel, and one of them was a South African. They're everywhere. I think it's a common immigration option, I think, for South Africans who are either frustrated at the economic situation there or maybe feel persecuted. You know, I tend to think a lot of these people sort of highlight their Judaism at the last minute know, just as a way to sort of get out of there. None of them really struck me as being really hardcore Jews. Like, they're certainly not like generational Hasidim. And there's also the diamond trade too. That's a significant component to this. So,
the Oppenheimers were big in the diamond trade there.
Well, isn't it De Beers?
The De Beers.
Yeah. So,
fascinating.
Yeah. So let me just finish this thought, and I'm happy to have you talk, Charles. So the diamond industry, the diamond cutting is one of the major employment sectors in Israel. So, from what I understand, you know, the diamonds come from South Africa, they come into Israel, they get cut there, and then they get shipped around the world, because you can really no longer run that kind of an operation in South Africa due to the political problems. So, you know, that kind of summarizes my understanding of it. You know, there may be more to it, you know, deeper kind of connections there, which are not necessarily public information.
So the three major groups of white South Africans are Afrikaners, Anglos, and Jews. And most of the South Africans I've met in the United States are either Anglo or Jewish. And the Jews have that connection to Israel with a right of return. And a lot of Anglo-South Africans have immigrated to the UK and Australia. But Afrikaners have, I mean, their ancestral home is primarily the Netherlands, but they basically have no strong ties to that nation. So they're the group that has had the most difficult time leaving. And also the dynamics are different. So they're much more in the agriculture sector. And if you're in a sort of urban business environment, then it's easier to find connections if you want to immigrate to the West, like say the United States or England or Israel. So if you're a farmer, it's a lot more difficult. But I read recently that Russia has taken in some Boer farmers, and I think Georgia has as well. And they're not doing it on humanitarian, altruistic grounds. They're doing so on practical grounds, because farmers are beneficial to their economy. But that group, the Afrikaners of Dutch descent, they're probably the least likely to immigrate abroad because they don't have that connection. Though actually, I think I'm not 100% sure, but I do think Elon Musk is of Afrikaner origin.
Robert, yes, he is.
I just wanted to ask you something. I mean, when you say Georgia, are you talking about the U.S. state of Georgia or the Republic of Georgia?
The Republic of Georgia of the former Soviet Union in the Caucasus region.
Because as it happens, I've just recently discovered through a friend of mine that there is a large influx of Afrikaner farmers. Or maybe it's a small influx, but a significant influx of Afrikaner farmers into Mississippi, at least, because basically, you know, American blacks no longer want to work in cotton fields or any kind of fields, they have shall we say other sources of income, primarily. And I'm looking at an article right now from the Delta Farm Press, which is the Mississippi Delta industry newspaper, and it's for skilled workers. Mississippi farmer Jeremy Jack recruits from South Africa for skilled farm workers, and so this is an opportunity that's perhaps being suppressed in the news media, but you know, in terms of reality, some people in the South, I guess, would rather have, if they can't have their traditional black workers in the fields, they'd rather have white workers than Mexicans, and they find the South Africans particularly culturally compatible. And in several different farms in Mississippi, major industrial farms, they are bringing in the South Africans, and it's interesting because they're coming in under skilled worker visas, skilled employee visas, obviously that's not an overall solution. But I think that one of the things we wanted to talk about a little bit, today was whether the United States should throw its doors wide open to South African white immigrants. And I, for one, am 100% in favor of throwing our doors completely open to white South African immigrants. And in preparation for this little gathering tonight, I did a little bit of research on the legal history of post-apartheid immigration from South Africa. I mean, I think you mentioned that, traditionally Jews and Anglos come in, and I've known all three as immigrants, even in the pre-the apartheid era. I knew Jewish immigrants from South Africa. I knew Anglos, and I knew Afrikaners too. Oddly enough, the Afrikaners that I knew were all lawyers. They came to the University of Chicago at a time when the University of Chicago was basically the only university in the United States that was still permitting South Africans to come over. The Jewish people were leaving South Africa during the apartheid era, despite the fact that for many, many years, the only opposition, the only standing opponent to apartheid in the South African parliament was Helene Suzma, who is Jewish and who has a rather odd connection my family, and one of my aunts was actually in love with her husband. It's a long story.
Yeah, that's interesting, fascinating. I really want to get to that issue with the agriculture thing. Is interesting is they have this specific niche of skilled farmers, and the way our kind of agriculture is set up in the United States is we have this these large corporate-owned farms. So there seems to be the majority of the employ of the farm workers employed, which is definitely the case in California's Central Valley, are these low-skilled workers, mostly illegal immigrants. So I'm not really a big expert on this, like what is the demand for skilled labor in agriculture. But, I mean, you do have, like, the wine industry in California, and the wine industry is huge in South Africa. I think South Africa is maybe like the one of not the top wine producer in the world. I mean, it's like France, California, and South Africa is maybe like fifth. But I'm just looking at photographs of South Africa, and especially the wine country, and it reminds me so much of California, like the central coast, places near where I live, and the wine country. So it's very, I mean, California. It reminds me a lot of California.
It's a very similar climate and very, very similar in a lot of different ways. There's another article I'm looking at the Clarion Ledger which is part of the USA Today network, has an article on South African immigrants in the southern economy. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's just really interesting. We could benefit so much from the influx of these people. And what I wanted to point out is an interesting thing is that South Africans, because of the geographic era, non-proximity, extreme non-proximity, they only come in as legal applicants for immigration. And in this, and part of the, I don't know if Trump has really thought deeply about this or not, but he's taken a strong stand against illegal immigration. And what I found when I did this research on Westlaw, looking up South African, white South African asylum applicants, there have been literally thousands of specific applications by white South Africans. And I think I sent you the set of 41 cases that specifically went on appeal and got published opinions.
And these were specifically to the United States, because I did hear about a case in Canada where this family petitioned the Canadian government for asylum, and the judge just blatantly dismissed them and said, this is white supremacist propaganda, get out of here. But you're talking about the United States.
Yeah, this is all the United States. I didn't do a search in Canada. As a matter of fact, I could have, but I didn't. I haven't done it yet. But here's what's interesting. It's not just South Africans who have white South Africans who have some of these cases. Going back to the era of apartheid, you were talking about the Boers and the Anglos and the Jewish population, but there were two other major ethnic groups other than the blacks in apartheid era South Africa, and those were the East Indians, the subcontinental Indians, like, you know, Mahatma Gandhi actually got his career start as an activist in South Africa a long, long time ago. So this is a very long established group in South Africa. And then also the colored people. Colored in South Africa means something very different from what it means in the United States. It's not just another word for black people. Colored in South Africa, specifically the mixed blood population, the black and white admixture. And in these cases that I examined, I pulled like seven of them handy for this. I guess 60% of these cases are whites, the people you'd expect. They don't do well at all. The other 40% are Indians, East Indians from the Indian subcontinent, and colored people, and they do equally badly. The only victory, and one of the most heavily litigated cases that I found, was a very interesting case where the group was not based on race, but based on family. And the case involved apparently the relatives of a particularly vicious white factory manager in the Natal province who was famous for physically and verbally abusing the black employees. And his relatives were actually granted asylum based on reasonable fear of persecution as his relatives. And again, I think that in a structural way, that becomes a very interesting issue, because, you know, I don't know how Joshua feels about the concept of the Jewish race as sort of extended family, but certainly race up to a point is a concept of relatedness, of similar ancestry, similar blood. You know, you and I once, I guess when we were planning this, we were talking about how the Afrikaners, one reason that they're perhaps more reluctant to leave is that farmers really are much more connected by blood and soil to the land they work.
Because if you're, say, a lawyer, you have money in your bank account and you have your law license, and it's hard to get on the bar in a foreign country, but at least you have those assets. If you're a farmer, your wealth is in your land, so you basically would have to give up everything and basically start from scratch with nothing, unless there was some, say, foreign company that was willing to hire you. So say you had skills in, say, the wine industry in South Africa, and you found some winery in Napa Valley that was going to hire you for your skills, but that's just a very small niche. So if you're a farmer, all your wealth is in your land.
Let me just hit this right in the... So the term that you use, Charles, I'm not sure if you're even aware of this, but do you know where the term blood and earth comes from?
I know where the term blut und Erde comes from.
It comes from Nazi Germany. In fact, it was developed by them. And I'm not going to use that as a way to sort of label your belief system, but it's certainly an indicator, you know, of what is our pedigree, ideological pedigree that we're looking at here.
So anyhow, what we were discussing is the whole issue of if you're a farmer, it's very difficult to move to another country unless you're willing to kind of sacrifice everything and start from scratch in poverty, unless there's some kind of a charity or government that is willing to give you financial aid. So there's that issue. And then you could talk about kind of this issue of right of return. So Israel has this law under right of return. So if you're Jewish, you can apply, and basically you're granted Israeli citizenship. So if you talk about this idea, there's this idea of a Jewish diaspora, and if you look at it as in the context of like a European diaspora, like should there be like a right of return?
Robert, aren't you saying shouldn't there be a right to survive by coming here to the United States? I mean, is that what you're really asking? What are you
Yeah,
asking?
Exactly. Should we just open up the doors? And I mean, I would basically support that.
They are our cousins. I mean, they are literally our cousins in some cases, and they are in the racial sense. They're so welcome here in many parts of the South because they're culturally identical. I mean, even during the apartheid era, one of the comments of travel guides to South Africa was, it's a foreign country, and one of the most surprising things about it is how unforeign it feels. It feels very much like, you know, at least in the white areas, it felt very much like the suburban United States.
So you're talking about, so yeah, I agree with you completely. We should have open immigration in that regards. But as far as culture goes, with the Anglos, there's a connection to the Anglosphere. Is there also a connection with the culture of the Afrikaners, who are primarily Dutch? And America does have a Dutch colonial background as well.
Places like New York City.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, my family, in fact, I have Dutch colonial ancestors.
Yeah,
my grandmother.
The Roosevelts were, the two Roosevelt presidents were, you know, scions of Dutch families, as was Martin Van Buren. I mean, we've had a lot of Dutch involvement in our culture, but I think that in the modern world, I mean, looking at these reports from Mississippi, they're indistinguishable. They're the kind of foreigners who come here and, you know, okay, they may have a little bit of an accent when they start out, but basically they are exactly the same mix of capitalists who are used to hard work and yet expect a certain amount of support from the state. Their culture is indistinguishable from ours, and consider that people on the left are all about the humanity of immigration and how everyone who really needs to come here or really wants to come here should have the chance to do it. I mean, this is a group that not only does it cost nothing to bring them in, because few, if any, of them are going to become wards of the state. They're genetically programmed, culturally programmed to work, to be hard workers. But in addition, just in terms of education, they are not going to be competing for jobs that people want. I mean, my friend who is in Mississippi said that, basically, they are willing to do hard work and hard but skilled labor that no one else is willing to do. And so
Hold on. So your presumption here is that there's no white welfare recipients? Is basically part of the foundation?
I said that none of the people in South Africa were going to contribute to that. I mean, if you're talking about the opiate problem and the problem of sort of downward social mobility in a lot of parts of white America, I'm very well aware of that. And I guess eventually...
Well, it just depends what case you're making, because if you're looking at things from a purely economic terms, then you only want people just for their economic benefit. If you're looking at things from a sort of nationalist perspective. So, I mean, look at going back to Israel. Israel has taken in groups like from, say, Jews from Yemen, and I'm sure those groups are economic. A lot of them disproportionately use social services, but Israel still lets them in under the laws of return. So it depends what outlook you want to take, a purely economic outlook or a nationalistic outlook that is based on...
To offer an anecdote there, when I first came to Israel, we went on, it was through some trip, and there was they kind of like integrate some IDF soldiers in the tour with everybody so that we can meet them. There was one girl there, and she was from, her parents were from Yemen, and she looked very Yemenite. She was quite dark, good-looking girl, looked very Arabic in my view, and she was on her way to become a doctor. So, you know, she was very driven to get out of that sort of rut of poverty, and, you know, by all estimations, she was going to be an asset to the Israeli state. So, you know, kind of, there's certainly facts that defy this idea that darker people are somehow liabilities. I think, you know, some Charles points like this. What you're saying, Charles, is basically, I'm reading this like you feel that these Afrikaners are somehow endowed with a special ability to make money, you know, where maybe other groups aren't. I'm not really sure I agree with that. You know, if they came here and they had no money, what do you think the chances are?
I have no idea where you're getting that out of what I said. All I said was that the groups that are coming in, a lot of these are very substantial people. They are not primarily economic refugees. They are primarily social and political refugees. And the great South African defense to why it's not true that there's genocide going on against the white people is because they say these are victims of crime, not official policy. And yet the social and the political atmosphere of South Africa is such that crimes against black people are basically, shall we say, very popular. And they're not easily or readily arrested and prosecuted. So there is no effective protection for the white South Africans. And what I'm saying is that most of these people, possibly because of their privileged position in pre-1994 South Africa, they come from land, they come from the middle and upper classes, and by and large, I think that they're going to be one of the most easily assimilable groups that's coming into the United States right now, and we should make it entirely legal instead of subjecting them to this incredibly high standard of proving that. I'm not even sure that these cases could be so difficult anymore. I mean, most of the published cases I'm looking at are 2004 to 2011, 2012. And that was before the widespread awareness of the farm murders came. And I mean, they were complaining about the same sort of thing. They were complaining about how they were disproportionately victims of crime, and they were not being afforded, shall we say, the equal protection of the law.
There's this concept under the United Nations called stages of genocide, and
yes.
I forget the specific list. I think, is it 8 stages? But Charles, are you familiar with that? And what stage would you say that they're in now?
Oh, I think that South Africa, they are very close to the to a stage 8. And there are two ways it's been graded. One is 8 levels, and one is 10 levels. And either way, they're close to the top level in South Africa. They are being murdered because there are people in government who do sing the song, kill the bear, kill the bear. Nelson Mandela sang that song on more than one occasion. You can find him on YouTube singing it. And, that's not just a cutesy little little slogan. It's an actual, if it's not an official policy of the government, it's an officially tolerated form of expression. And
I think we look at this as a form of it's a kind of a tragedy of technological development, right? I mean, if we allow these forces, these demographic forces, to overpower the Afrikaners and other related groups, then what will we have? We'll have a
genocide.
First, all those people will probably lose their livelihoods. And secondly, South Africa will cease to be a first world nation. It will be like Botswana, which, by the way, has the highest AIDS rate of any country on Earth. So I think anyone could agree that, that's not a desirable outcome. So, Charles, I want to ask you, how do you solve this problem?
What do you mean moving around? I mean, if we say that everyone who needs a refuge here can have it, and just say that that we're going to open our doors to the whites of South Africa, and, unless you're actually under indictment for murder or something, you can come in. We will take your not so wretched, your not so poor, paraphrasing the lines on the statute of limitations. I see it as a no lose proposition to admit the Afrikaners and the Anglos and the Jews of South Africa if they want to come, and it's basically up to them. If they do want to come, and if they want to stay in their native land and try to defend, Orania or similar little settlements like that, okay, fine. I mean, it doesn't compel anybody to do anything. It basically maximizes freedom for people who really deserve it. And I just cannot see how. In this world where we're basically legalizing one wave of illegal immigrants from the south of the border after another, why we would not equally generously just legally throw open the doors to these people. One of the cases I was reading, under the Obama administration, I guess they knew that they had no chance of claiming racial discrimination. So they said that it was the social group that they belonged to that was being discriminated against was white policemen, and they were getting that desperate to come up with inventive ways of being admitted to this country. And I say, let's be humanitarians. We let the Vietnamese come in. They were mostly unskilled and unpropertied. We let the Vietnamese come in because they had been our allies in the Vietnam War. We let all sorts of waves of immigrants come in at different times in our history. And if those who support basically free immigration and free borders have any sincerity at all, they should say, okay, we put humongous pressure on the Republic of South Africa to give up apartheid. So this problem is basically a result of, it was a foreseeable result of our policies.
So just with the whole future of South Africa, that country is not sustainable, and things are only going to get much worse. And there's the whole humanitarian issue, of course, because the situation there is going to get really ugly. And I don't think the nation can be salvaged. But just as far as what you were saying about immigration, we want to bring in people that are the most compatible with our culture. And that was kind of that whole narrative. I mean, that makes logical sense, but that narrative has changed with sort of post-65 immigration policies. But I basically agree with what you're saying.
They're our cousins. Well, that's what I said. They are our brothers and our cousins and our sisters, in my case, literally, and our aunts. There's no downside to opening the doors to this particular refugee population in an unqualified way. I don't think there is. I mean, Joshua was asking this question about what is the, if this is a good thing for South Africa, and my point, I guess right at the point we lost contact, was that I don't care what the consequences are for South Africa, because we as a people, our government is directly responsible for the collapse, the unnatural, the premature death of the apartheid government, the Republic of South Africa, the Nationalist Republic of South Africa. That country could have survived a lot longer, maybe 100 years longer, if we had not put international sanctions that strangulated one of the strongest economies in the world. We destroyed Nationalist South Africa, and so we and they were saying, you know, that they would be subject to genocide, that they would be subject to being wiped out, because they saw what was going on in neighboring Rhodesia all during the 80s and early 90s. Nobody had any illusions about what it meant to put Nelson Mandela in the presidency. It was a slow death for the white people of South Africa. And, you know, if they can recover, become at least as good as, say, Tanzania. Tanzania is a fairly, is not a failed nation. Kenya is not a failed nation. A lot of the other countries in Africa really are failed nations, but Kenya and Tanzania and Zambia, up to a point, are examples of African nations that have
flooded. Yeah, it's gotten, I mean, so situation's so bad, actually, a lot of these white farmers are finding it safer to move to other African nations, like some of, like, places like Namibia, and even, I mean, some of them have even gone to some of these really poor African nations that have welcomed them in. But that's, I mean, that's just how bad it is, that they're desperate. And also, I mean, they've gone to Georgia, and Georgia is a very poor country, so a lot of them are pretty desperate to get out. But yeah, basically, I pretty much agree with you. We should allow them to come in.
Georgia is a very interesting country. I mean, I guess it's relatively poor by European standards, but it is the home of Joseph Stalin, and another major Soviet leader, Chalikashvili. It was a very prosperous part of the Soviet Union. But anyhow, sidebar. I think that the interesting thing is that immigration policy in the United States recently has all about been letting people in no matter what. Even if they're totally illegal, they cross the border with their coyotes and in the trunks of cars. Doesn't matter. They dig a tunnel under the border. It doesn't matter. The left wants to let them in. And, you know, to say that you want to let in all these illegals and that you don't just want to throw open the door to people who are just like us, there's an agenda there. And unfortunately, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess Joshua will be horrified when he hears me talking about this, but I think that the big problem is that the left really wants to end a white America, and they realize...
So, just looking at the statistics, there's about 4.5 million whites in South Africa, so that's roughly the equivalent of the Asian population of California and the number of Chinese in the overall United States. So, I mean, that would have some impact on the demographic composition of the United States, maybe modest, but to some degree.
And also notable, 4.5 million extra whites is roughly half, maybe a third, the estimated number of illegal aliens in this country, most of whom are Mexican and Central American, who can't be counted precisely because they're illegal. So I mean, it's hard to get a grip on that particular demographic, but unless you just think that white people are evil and that white people need to be kept out of this country, there's no excuse from a leftist perspective, of locking out the South African whites. They are subject to genocidal conditions. By any reading of the 8 or 10 stage program developed by the United States State Department and adopted in the United Nations, they are very much like us, the majority population. But I mean, you know, this gets into a whole different issue of, is there a policy, at least, you know, to look at the Bush, the Bush, you know, the Bush administration is where most of these cases are that I pulled on Westlaw. Bush and first term Obama is pretty good. They gave up after 2012, it seems like. I don't see any cases coming through. And, you know, was there under Bush and Obama basically a conscious decision to de-whiten America, to take out the whiteness of America?
So, Charles Lincoln, I would like to thank you for being on, and Joshua will be coming on next.
It's been my pleasure, Robert, and hope to talk to you again soon, and I look forward to seeing this come out.
Thank you. Take care. Joshua, I just concluded the part with Charles. Do you have any final thoughts on the issue of allowing white South Africans to immigrate here?
I mean, I'm certainly not against the idea. I don't really see any particular reason why we shouldn't. Although I think I disagree with Charles' idea that they're going to be somehow quality immigrants. I'll give you a good example. You know, there was a famous sort of rap group that was comprised of two white South Africans. I forget their name. And they were basically glorifying all the sorts of behaviors that I think Charles was citing as degeneracy. So to say that, you know, these people are of some sort of superior moral fiber by mere heredity.
You know, yeah. You know what's interesting is just on the record, actually, I do agree with him that we should allow white South Africans to immigrate here, but also accept basically that white people are flawed. So Brandon Adamson, we were talking about this issue with Konstantin von Hofmeister, and Brandon was making the same point that you are, that, I mean, absolutely, we should allow people to immigrate here. And I think nations do have an obligation to help out people as refugees who are closest to them. So, I mean, Israel has that
right
with Jewish refugees. And I also think in the Middle East, I mean, there should be some kind of country, ideally Lebanon, that would be a homeland for Middle Eastern Christians. And then the United
sure
States should take in Europeans that are fleeing persecution. So on that principle, I mean, I do absolutely support letting them in here. But you do have a valid point, because I think some people in the alt-right maybe take it way too far, or they have this fetishization that these are all going to be these people who are ultra-traditionalist and like have these like hardcore right-wing views. So yes, I do
right
think we should let them in. But I think at the same time, I do agree that you and Brandon Adamson have a valid point.
Well, I think in the case of von Hofmeister, I mean, he lives in Russia and he's coming from Europe. And anyone who's been to Russia can see quite clearly that white does not necessarily mean that you're of some kind of superior moral fiber. There's a lot of people there that live the sort of lives that are quite similar to maybe you know, like some ghetto in Detroit or something like that. So, you know, I can imagine von Hofmeister agrees. I'm very, very acquainted with his viewpoints. So,
with the whole economic angle, on the show we do with Israel, we were talking about a social nationalism. And in South Africa, there, within the Afrikaner community in Orania, they have social nationalism on a small scale, where this community has their own social safety net, social programs that look out for each other. But, I mean, traditionally, whites in South Africa have been more capitalist, kind of comparable. You were making the comparison, like the relationship between the right wing and Israel. And traditionally, whites in South Africa have been more capitalist. But I kind of understand social nationalism works best in a nation that's homogenous. So if you're a small minority that's prosperous at say, like 9%, you're not going to want to have social nationalism with a large underclass that strongly resents you.
Or especially if you don't feel a kind of kinship with. You know, I think Charles sort of, you know, he hit on some of these points. And Israel's a good example. You know, it's just one that I know, so that's why I'll talk about it. You know, you have the Ashkenazi, and, you know, they don't necessarily want to share with the Arabs for a variety of reasons. Some of them are cultural custom sort of things, and other ones are that, you know, some Ashkenazi guy doesn't want his daughter marrying this person who doesn't look like him. You know, that's just kind of like standard racism. You know, so that's part of it. I think some of those themes also echoed in some of Charles's viewpoints, to be completely sincere with you. So
this is a totally off topic, but we were kind of talking about the issue of kind of Bauhaus and brutalism on our Israel show, and I was doing some research on architecture in South Africa, and there was actually a lot of brutalism in Johannesburg built in the 1970s, and there's this really interesting place in Johannesburg called the Ponte Tower, and it's this giant brutalist tower. It has this massive atrium in the middle and this big neon sign on the top. And it was originally built as housing, I don't know if it was luxury housing or at least housing for the middle classes during the apartheid era, but now it's basically, it went through this period where it was really dangerous, and it's improved somewhat, but it's kind of almost like a prison where residents have to go through these checkpoints. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of an interesting reflection on the whole political situation there. But it is interesting that the architecture, if you're interested in that kind of architecture, I'd recommend looking up the Ponte Tower.
Yeah, and I think I linked you that before the show. Is that the same one, or is this something different?
Yeah, it's a YouTube video you linked to me.
Okay, well, there's this tower. I don't know too much about the tower that you had just cited there, but
that's the one,
you know,
Ponte.
Okay, right. So that tower was basically taken over by feral South Africans, and then it just became like an all-out, like sort of like a guerrilla warfare kind of scenario, which is really like, you know, it's that's pretty awful if you ask me. You know, and it certainly tells a story about how bad things got in South Africa, and kind of, you know, it rouses up sympathy for the white side of the equation. You know, maybe their viewpoint isn't all that bad. You know, there's certainly a problem with things degenerating back into a form of savagery. I don't think anyone really wants that to happen. And certainly not every white is guilty of the things that the international community and the UN charged them with. I'll tell you an interesting story. There was one South African guy that I knew, and he told me that, you know, when he was growing up, it was actually quite normal to sort of have a what they call a black guy around who would just do things for them. And then, they would feed the black guy, they would house him, maybe pay him, essentially something not really unlike slavery. But the person, this native tribal African did this 100% voluntarily. He was not coerced in any way. He did it because his standards of living were much higher if, you know, he submitted to this arrangement than it would be if he had not. You know, you'd be living in a hut somewhere or something. You know, and that tells a kind of interesting story that, you know, it's not really quite as simple as a lot of people are making it out to be, like that it's a one-sided thing, you know, whites exploiting the blacks. There's also was reciprocity there as well. You know, in some cases, the black population were volunteering for that. You know, it was a mutually beneficial scenario. And in that sense, you know, I can somewhat sympathize with Charles' viewpoints. I definitely do not agree with how he sort of characterizes the situation there. But I think it's really important they want a solution. You know, and if they want a solution in Israel, you know, they have to look at both sides. It's not just a matter of, like, victim, dark person, and criminal white person. That's certainly destructive.
So your point is that both outlooks are way too simplistic.
Absolutely. I mean, you need to just, to me, I think something that needs to be tried at this juncture is just, you know, treat everybody, get get any racial term, black or white, remove that from the law books. You know, you cannot, there's no such thing, do not even recognize or acknowledge the existence of race in the law, and treat everybody with some kind of a standardized set of rights like we have here in America. And, you know, the law kind of extrapolates from that. The problem is that race is not really something that's even well-defined in the law. You know, there's no easy way to say who's black and who's white. That comes up all the time. Like, you have people like Rachel Dolezal. Are you familiar with this person?
Oh, yeah. She said she was black in the same way as, like, an identity, but she was not.
Yeah, or she, I mean, you look at pictures of her as a kid. She's got, like long blonde hair.
We are at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Joshua, do you have any last comments on this topic of South Africa or any other, other issue?
I think I said my piece. I'm not sure if me and Charles agree a lot on how to do things. I think that these problems are going to continue, and they're going to continue in Israel until people sort of wise up and just start installing a standardized civil rights system. That's really what I think is the solution to everything.
So, yeah, I'll make one last point. With Israel, if you exclude, say, the occupied areas, whatever you want to call them, then there's still a strong Jewish majority in Israel. So if Arabs are, say, 20% of the population and you give them equal rights, it's not the end of the world. But with South Africa, because the situation is so dire, whites are down to maybe 9%, and the majority supports political party the ANC, which is explicitly hostile. So I don't really think that country can be salvaged. I think immigrating to the West is probably the only solution.
So you think it's going to collapse back into something like, you know, one of these third world African states?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know if it's going to be like a massive genocide or a gradual thing, but the future is very bleak. So I think immigration to the United States or other Western countries is the only solution.
Well, right, so it's like a moral imperative to sort of, for the safety of these individuals who really don't have a state and a home at this point. And I agree with that part of it. Like, maybe some of the situation will be diffused if we take some of the real serious victims of this collision of social ideas and then just give them a home. You know, here you go, here's a house in Houston or something like this. And but, you know, it poses the question, like, what do we do about South Africa? You know, how did it go wrong, right? I mean, how do we prevent this from happening again? You know, we could put a Band-Aid on it, but that doesn't necessarily solve the basic problem. We still don't have a clear concept of what are the ethical principles at work, and I think we should.
Joshua Zeidner, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
You're welcome, as always, Robert, and it's always a great pleasure and honor to be on your show.